titles appear on a black background. Miramax Films presents a Saul's Ants production. An Anthony Minghella film. Now a soft light illuminates a coarse, grainy surface. More titles. Ralph Fiennes as Count Almashi. Juliette Binoche as Hannah. Willem Dafoe as Caravaggio. And Kristen Scott Thomas as Catherine Clifton in The English Patient. Now a slender paintbrush hovers above the grainy surface. The damp bristles curve over the coarse ochre texture in gentle strokes of brown. More titles. Naveen Andrews, Colin Firth, Julian Wadham, Jürgen Prochnow, Kevin Whateley, Clive Merrison, Nino Castelnuovo, Hisham Rustam, and Peter Ruhring. The gliding brush paints two hammer-shaped lines, then joins their stems like open scissors. Titles continue. Film editor Walter Murch, ACE. Casting Michelle Geish and David Rubin, CSA. Costume designer Anne Roth. Line producer Alessandro von Norman. Executive producers Bob Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein, and Scott Greenstein. Associate producers Paul Zantz and Steve Andrews. With light fluid strokes, the brush extends the scissored lines into a graceful arch. Titles continue. Original music composed by Gabriel Yared. Production designer Stuart Craig. Director of photography John Seal, ACS. Based on the novel by Michael Ondaatje. Screenplay by Anthony Minghella. Produced by Saul Zantz. Directed by Anthony Minghella. As the glistening brown paint dries flat, the abstract painting begins to take human form. The scissored legs flow into the graceful arch of a prone person's torso. Two bent arms reach in front of the slender body. A round head completes the figure. The painting dissolves, and for a moment, the slender body remains a shadow floating over a rippled desert. The figure fades into the smooth, shapely dunes. As the contours undulate in and out of sunlight, the shadow of an airplane rides across the silken sand. The pilot, wearing goggles over his leather skullcap, sits in the rear seat. In front of him, the sun warms a woman's delicate sleeping face. The wind blows her sandy blonde hair over the pilot's small windshield. Far ahead of them, the vast crater desert blurs into the hazy sky. As the silver biplane soars over a dune, a shirtless soldier runs into a foxhole. A German artilleryman swings a field gun. Bullets rake the biplane. The pilot hunkers down as smoke billows from the engine. An orange flame sweeps over the woman. The pilot stands up to reach her and fire engulfs him. The blaze grows white hot, then fades to black. Now in a rocking train, a slim young nurse fastens a pinafore over her blue dress. She walks past bunks of wounded men. Smiling, she visits a young soldier.
How are you?
Okay.
Your leg will be fine. A lot of shrapnel came out. I saved you the pieces.
You are the prettiest girl I've ever seen.
I don't think so.
Would you kiss me?
No. I'll get you some tea.
It means such a lot to me.
Would it?
He nods. Tenderly touching his damp hair, she kisses him.
Thank you.
She leaves, passing more wounded men.
Nurse, I can't sleep. Would you kiss me?
Oh. You're so pretty. Will you let me in, please?
Very funny. Go to sleep now.
She enters a surgery car.
Don't ask.
In the desert, Arab nomads gather wreckage from the downed plane. One of the Bedouins fingers a thimble-shaped pendant, while another kneels beside the burned pilot. His raw, skinless face gleams red. He stirs as the kneeling Bedouin gently covers him. Nearby, two nomads peruse a leather-bound book, holding letters and a painted postcard. The kneeling Bedouin lays a gauze with cut-out breathing holes over the pilot's blistered face, then covers it with a grass-woven sunscreen. Later, wind-blown sand skates over the dunes as the Bedouins lead a plodding camel caravan across the desert. On a stiff litter, strapped to a camel's back, the pilot lies covered against the sun. Through the mesh sunscreen, he glimpses the nomads trekking ahead of him. They walk in the cool shadow of a dune under silver, sun-streaked clouds. Now, twilight spreads a dim light across a field hospital where soldiers unload a wounded man from an ambulance. In a tent for injured soldiers, the slim, khaki-uniformed nurse walks beside a young woman.
God, I hate giving blood. Can't stand needles.
Later, a helmeted doctor closes a soldier's johnny over blood-stained stomach bandages.
Is there anybody from Picton?
Picton? I don't know.
I'd like to see somebody from home before I go.
The doctor warmly pats his shoulders, then opens a curtain. The slim nurse and her apple-cheeked friend lie on cots.
Do we have anybody from Picton?
Why Picton?
He's from the edge of Lake Ontario, right, soldier?
That's where your suite is from, isn't it? Around there?
Ask him what company he's with.
3rd Canadian Fusiliers.
3rd Canadian Fusiliers.
Does he know Captain McGann?
He bought it yesterday. Shot to bits.
What did he say?
Doesn't know him.
Hannah, get down!
The doctor drags the nurse down as shells rack the tent. Hannah writhes on the dirty floor.
He's dead. He's dead.
Now, in the desert, a silver-bearded Arab shoulders a wooden yoke and steps into a cave where the Bedouins sit by a fire. One of them helps him stand the yoke on two stilts. Glass vials filled with brightly colored fluids dangle from the wooden crossbar. The turbaned newcomer kneels by a pool where the pilot soaks, his face covered by the woven screen. The Arab removes it, then peels off the gauze mask, exposing the pilot's blackened features. From the standing yoke, the Arab chooses a bottle, then mixes a dark paste in his hands. He lightly touches the pilot's charred flesh, spreading the ointment over his glistening red cheeks. The pilot stirs. His gaze rolls back, showing the ghostly whites of his eyes. Now, foaming surf curls gently onto the sand in front of the beach hospital. A subtitle appears. Italy, October 1944. On a porch, a military officer stands by the cot of the downed pilot.
Name, rank, serial number.
No, sorry. I think I was a pilot. I was found in the wreckage of a plane at the beginning of the war.
Can you remember where you were born?
Am I being interrogated? You should be trying to trick me, make me speak German, which I can, by the way.
Why? Are you German?
No.
How do you know you're not German if you don't remember anything?
Might I have a sip of water?
Thick, branching scars cover his gaunt face. Hannah, the slim, brown-haired nurse, puts a spouted cup to his mouth and pours water between his stiff lips.
Thank you.
It's okay.
I remember lots of things. I remember a garden plunging down to the sea. Nothing between you and France.
This was your garden?
Or my wife's.
You were married then?
I think so. although I believe that to be true of a number of Germans.
The officer smiles reluctantly.
Look, I have this much lung. The rest of my organs are packing up. What could it possibly matter if I'm a Tutankhamun? I'm a bit of toast, my friend. Sorry, I can't help you.
Later, an ambulance caravan rolls through a ravaged town. In the back of one of the covered army trucks, Hannah crouches beside the pilot's stretcher. The bumpy ride jostles him.
Are you all right? I know you hate to be moved. I'm sorry.
Behind them, in a jeep, a soldier drives Hannah's young friend up to the ambulance.
Hannah! Jan!
Jan stands up.
It's meant to be Lace in the next village. The boys are going to take me. You don't have any money, do you?
Nope.
Just in case there's silk.
No.
Hannah, I know you do. Come on.
No.
Oh, come on. I swear to God, this will be the last time, I swear. She's a softie. She loves me.
Hannah passes her some cash.
I'll pay you back, I promise.
I'm not sewing anything else for you.
I love you.
They blow each other a kiss. The jeep speeds ahead on the shoulder, and Hannah returns to the pilot. Sunlight slivers through the slatted wall onto his purple-scarred face. Up ahead, Jan's jeep cuts in front of the caravan. Hannah watches flames engulf the jeep. Her truck stops, and she jumps out.
Get some water over here! Jan. Oh, no.
Hannah runs toward the smoking jeep. The bloody driver lies in twisted metal. A soldier intercepts Hannah's charge. She resists his embrace, then sags in his arms. Later, near the charred jeep, two soldiers listening to headphones sweep the gravel road with metal detectors. One of the mine sappers, an Indian wearing a turban, walks cautiously ahead of his tall English partner. Standing near the caravan, Hannah watches numbly. The black-bearded Indian lays his detector down, drops to his knees, and draws his bayonet. Lying on his stomach, he gently scrapes the dirt with a long silver blade, then brushes dust away from a donut-sized mine. Hannah strides briskly past him.
Hey, don't move!
Don't move!
Stand absolutely still! You're walking in a minefield!
Hannah freezes, staring down at the road.
Good. That's good.
The tall sapper approaches.
Just stay still for me. I'm gonna be fine.
He clutches her shoulders.
What are you doing? What the bloody hell do you think you're doing?
She eyes a gold bracelet.
It's Jan's.
The sapper clenches his lips, carefully picks up the gold bracelet, then lays it gently in Hannah's palm. Wrapping his arm around her shoulder, he leads her back down the same path in the road. They pass the Indian sapper lying motionless on the road, inches from the mine. He goes back to work. Later, Hannah stands by the pilot as stretcher bearers remove him from the ambulance.
Are you in pain? Do you need something?
Yes.
A tall nurse approaches Hannah.
Are you okay?
He went down.
We keep moving him in and out of the trap. Why?
He's dying. What's the point?
Oh, we can hardly leave him. Do you mean leave him?
No. I don't mean leave him.
Hannah kneels in the grass beside his stretcher and opens a vial of morphine. Under a wool blanket, he lies flat on his back.
This will help you.
She assembles a syringe.
I must be a curse. Anybody who loves me, anybody who gets close to me, oh, I must be cursed.
She lifts her gaze to a shadow-black hilltop where a lofty stone tower catches the sun.
Which is it?
The patient offers his gnarled hand. Gently squeezing it, Hannah smiles faintly. Her somber gaze settles on the distant tower, jutting out of the dark landscape. Morning. Hannah walks up a dirt road toward the tower, the belfry of an old stone building. As she stares up at an arched opening adorned with a cross, her brimmed helmet shades her smooth porcelain complexion from the dawning sun. Trees sway in a gentle breeze as Hannah passes through an archway into an overgrown orchard. An iron railing fences in a small cistern. The algae-spotted water reflects Hannah's slender figure. Entering a gaping hole in a stone wall, she climbs over a pile of books into a ransacked library. Across from a covered piano, leaning bookshelves lead to several still standing. Later, Hannah shoulders open a door. At one end of the spacious room, a vaulted alcove harbors an altar. She studies the high ceiling, painted with faded frescoes, then unfolds a dusty mattress onto a metal bed frame. Her shifting eyes brighten. Later, back at the caravan, she walks with a lanky soldier.
When he dies, I'll catch up.
It's not safe here. The whole country's crawling with bandits, Germans, and God knows what. It's madness. I can't allow it.
The war is over. How can it be desertion?
It's not over everywhere. I didn't mean literally. This is normal. It's shock for all of us, Hannah.
I need morphine, a lot, and a pistol.
She adds a bundle and a lantern to a stock of supplies.
If anything ever happened to you, I'd never forgive myself.
She gazes resolutely at him.
We're heading for Leghorn, the Vorno, the Italians call it. We'll expect you.
Later, in the bright room with faded frescoes, Hannah helps two stretcher bearers and the tall nurse lift her patient into bed. Hannah folds back his wool blankets and removes a damp cloth from his forehead. As the stretcher bearers leave, she pats one on the shoulder.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Hannah.
The tall nurse holds Hannah, and they exchange kisses.
Oh, Hannah.
I'll be okay. I'll catch up. Good.
Hannah closes the door behind her friend, then glances at her patient. His chest faintly rises and falls. Later, in an attic, Hannah unbuttons her shirt and watches her patient through a hole in the floor. Stripping to her brassiere, she ascends a short flight into an airy loft where she sits in a window, bathed in sunlight, with her wavy brown tresses cascading over her bare shoulders. She cuts her hair to her chin, watching the caravan disappear into the hazy countryside. She tosses a handful of curls out the window, then closes it and paces while she snips. Later in the library, Hannah carries an armload of books to a decrepit staircase. Wearing an old sweater over a faded red dress, she stacks the books to fill gaps in the steps. She stomps on a stack, testing its stability, then climbs the stairs and visits her patient.
What was all that banging? Were you fighting rats or the entire German army?
She props him up with pillows.
I was repairing the stairs. I found the library. And the books were very useful.
Before you find too many uses for those books, you might read some to me.
I think they're all in Italian, but I'll look, yes. What about your own book?
My book? Yes, Herodotus. Yes, you could read him.
Oh, I found plums. We have plums in the orchard.
She brings him his book.
We have an orchard.
Yeah. Herodotus is father of history. Do you know that?
I don't know anything.
She peels the plum with her teeth, then feeds him a bite. He chews it slowly, and she skins the rest, nibbling off a bit of fruit. A soft smile warms her face as she gently slides the juicy flesh between his scarred lips. Watching him chew feebly, she sucks the plum's purple skin.
It's a very plum.
Later outside, Hannah bathes under a spigot. An invigorated grin parts her lips as she soaks her cropped hair and splashes her face. Sitting up in a stone tub, she lathers her leg. Golden sunlight gleams on her pale shoulders. Inside, her patient lies on his side, staring at his leather-bound book on the night table. Branching scars line his gaunt face. His stiff, gnarled fingers reach for the book and pull it closer. Slowly opening it, he flips to a page marked with red foil and green tissue paper. His sunken gaze drifts away, and he knocks the book to the floor. Our view dissolves to the book in the hands of a tan, lean-featured European. Sketching a map in the book, he narrows his deep-set eyes as he listens to a white-bearded Arab. The old man's breath mists into the chill desert air. His eyes flit to the sky above an encampment. A yellow biplane comes in for a landing.
A mountain the shape of a woman's back. Good, good.
The stubble-faced European details his drawing. Later, in the back of a pickup truck, he rides over to the sandy expanse where the yellow biplane touches down. As the plane taxis to a stop, four men climb out of the truck to meet it. The European waits alone, wearing sunglasses, a white long-sleeved shirt and shorts. The truck driver, a wiry Englishman, waves to the pilot.
Hello, Jeffrey.
Welcome.
Madam.
Hello.
Welcome to the expedition.
How do you do?
Jeffrey Clifton. Splendid to finally meet you all.
This is Dante D'Agostino and Ziggy Berman, our archaeologist.
Beautiful plane.
And this is Sharifa Fouad, Egyptologist.
And this is my wife, Kat.
Pleased to meet
Hello.
You.
Hello.
The European watches the slender blonde hop down. Later, Jeffrey opens champagne.
To the International Sand Club.
I'll get cups.
Marvelous plane, did you know?
Yes.
Isn't it? The wedding present from Catherine's parents. I'm calling it Rupert Bear.
He shakes
Hello.
The European's
Jeffrey
hand.
Jeffrey Clifton.
All mashy.
We can finally consign my old bird to the scrap heap.
Mrs. Clifton, I'd like to present Count Thormashy.
Hello. Jeffrey gave me your monograph when I was reading up in the desert. Very impressive.
Thank you.
I wanted to meet the man who could write such a long paper with so few adjectives.
A thing is still a thing, no matter what you place in front of it. Big car, slow car, chauffeur-driven car.
Broken car.
Still a car.
Not much use, though.
Love. Romantic love. Platonic love. Filial love. Quite different things, surely.
Uxoriousness, that's my favourite kind of love. Excessive love of one's wife.
Jeffrey kisses her.
Now, there you have me.
Later, Almashi and Maddox ready a plane.
That tourist, absolute rot. Highly recommended by the Royal Geographic Society. She's charming and has read everything. He's meant to be a ruddy good flyer.
We don't need another pilot.
He can make aerial maps of the whole route.
You can't explore from the air, Maddox. If you could explore from the air, life would be very simple.
He holds the prop.
Contact.
In the cockpit, Maddox flips a switch.
Contact.
Later, the silver biplane soars past a sharp, abraded peak into a sun-baked valley. Against the sprawling blue sky, the Clifton's yellow biplane pulls alongside Maddox and Almashi. Jeffrey, piloting behind Catherine, exchanges a wave with them. Almashi points to the rugged countryside, then makes a square with his hands and bends his fingers as though snapping a picture. Jeffrey gives him a thumbs up, then photographs the ground. Catherine looks up at Almashi, and he waves. As her sandy blonde hair flutters under her helmet, a loose strand catches her brief smile. Below, a withered mountain chain ripples with gnarled finger-like slopes. Jeffrey takes a picture, then flashes a thumbs up and rolls his plane into a graceful upside-down turn. Cruising low over rolling brown foothills, the two planes drift apart. The folds of the landscape dissolve to the gentle gathers of a rumpled bedsheet. In the frescoed room, Hannah makes the bed around her patient.
I should try and move the bed. I want you to be able to see the view. It's good.
glimpse of you from a monastery.
I can already see.
How? How can you see anything?
Oh, no, not the window. I can't bear the light anyway. I can see all the way to the desert.
I'm turning you.
Exploring. Before the war, making maps. Is there sand in my eyes? Are you cleaning sand from my ears?
No sand. That's your morphine speaking.
As she straightens his pillow, his head rolls to one side. His glazed eyes stare distantly.
I can see my wife in that view.
Hannah leans over him.
Are you remembering more?
Could I have a cigarette?
Are you crazy?
Smiling, she tucks in the sheet on the other side of the bed.
Why? Why are you said to tell him to keep me alive?
Because I'm a nurse.
At night, Hannah plays hopscotch in the moonlight. A tree casts lacy shadows across the chain of chalk-drawn squares. She tosses a piece of metal into a numbered square, then hops around it. Through an open window, her patient listens with a far-off gaze. The scene changes to the desert camp. Under a pitch-black sky, Almashi's expedition team sits around a blazing fire. The silver-haired D'Agostino sings. He spins a champagne bottle in the sand.
Fashion tomato, a Long Island potato.
Catherine glances away from her dancing husband to share a smile with Almashi. Now in the monastery, Hannah reads Herodotus to her patient.
The king insisted that he would find some way to prove beyond dispute that his wife was fairest of all women. I will hide you in the room where we sleep. Say Candlelis. Said Candlelis.
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 Now Catherine stands by the fire.
Candlelis tells Gyges that the queen has the same practice every night. She takes off her clothes and puts them on the chair by the door to her room.
Hannah.
And from where you stand, you will be able to gaze on her at your leisure.
Catherine.
And that evening, it's exactly as the king has told him. She goes to the chair, removes her clothes one by one, until she's standing naked in full view of Gyges. And indeed, she was more lovely than he could have imagined. But then the queen looked up and saw Gyges concealed in the shadows. And although she said nothing, she shuddered.
She stares unblinking at Almashi.
And the next day, she sends for Gyges and challenged him. And hearing his story, this is what she said.
Off with his head.
Catherine grins at Geoffrey's quip.
She said, either you must submit to death for gazing on that which you should not, or else kill my husband who has shamed me and become king in his place.
Geoffrey's smile fades.
So Gyges kills the king, marries the queen, and becomes ruler of Lydia for 28 years. The end.
Her eyes flicker self-consciously.
Should I spin the bottle?
So, Geoffrey, let that be a lesson.
D'Agostino.
Back in the dark monastery.
Are you asleep?
Yes. No.
Hannah shuts the book and gets up from her chair. Closing her eyes, she kisses his leathery forehead. Her wool army jacket hangs hip-length over her cotton dress. She turns down the oil lamp on his nightstand, then picks up a glowing lantern. Her patient's glistening eyes follow her across the room. Carrying the lantern out, Hannah leaves him in darkness. At At dawn, the sun rises into an amber sky. Hannah strolls through the monastery's overgrown orchard. In a freshly tilled garden, she finds black crows pecking at the soil. She chases them off, flailing her arms. She heaves out a breath as she glares at the garden. Later, in an overgrown cemetery, she finds a rusty iron cross 6 feet tall. Outside the gated entrance, a thin, wiry man wearing a black beret sits on a bicycle.
Buongiorno. Hannah?
What do you want?
I met your friend Mary. She said I should stop and see if you were all right. Apparently, we're neighbors. My house is 2 blocks from yours in Montreal. Cabot, north of Laurier.
Hannah smiles.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
He holds out an egg.
For you. I'd like to take credit for it, but it's for Mary. My name is David Caravaggio, but nobody ever called me David Caravaggio. They find too absurd to miss out on.
He pretends to pull another egg from behind her ear, then drops it.
Oh, shit. Stupid hands.
Let me do that.
She brings the broken egg into the kitchen. Caravaggio follows her and removes his beret.
They're fresh. I haven't had an egg in.
While she's turned, he pockets 2 morphine vials.
Have you noticed there are chickens? In Italy, you get chickens, but no eggs. In Africa, there are always eggs, but never chickens. Who separated them?
You were in Africa?
Yes, I was.
So was my patient.
She scrambles the eggs.
Look, I'd like to stay for a while. I have to do some work here. I speak the language. There are partisans to be disarmed. We embrace them and see if we can relieve them of their weapons, you know, while we hug. I was a thief, so the army thought I'd be good at it.
So you can shoot a pistol?
No.
She winces.
Do you have a problem with those?
He lowers his thumbless hands.
No.
Well, I should look at them before you go.
Look, it's a big place. We needn't disturb each other. I'll sleep in the stable. It doesn't matter where I sleep. I don't sleep.
I don't know what Mary told you about me, but I don't need company. I don't need to be looked after.
Later, she brings an omelet into her patient's room and pours a glass of water.
There's a man downstairs. He brought us eggs. He might stay.
Why? Can he lay eggs?
He's Canadian.
Why are people always so happy when they collide with someone from the same place? What happened in Montreal when you passed a man in the street? Did you invite him to live with you?
In the hall, Caravaggio eavesdrops.
He needn't disturb you.
He can't. I'm already disturbed.
There's a war. Where you come from becomes important.
Why? I hate that idea.
She spoon-feeds him some omelette. Later, she hangs a lace curtain over his bed.
Work.
Gently.
Caravaggio appears in the doorway. The patient studies his unshaven face.
Can I help?
Oh, it's finished.
So you're our Canadian pickpocket? Thief, I think is more accurate. I understand you are in Africa. Whereabouts? Oh, all over. All over? I kept trying to cover a very modest portion and still failed. Are you leaving us?
Yes.
Now's our opportunity to spot war wounds.
Oh, then I'm definitely going.
She goes upstairs to the loft and overhears them.
Does she have war wounds? I think anybody she ever loves tends to die on her. Are you planning to be the exception? Me? I think you've got the wrong end of the stick, old boy. So, Caravaggio. Hannah thinks you invented your name. And you've forgotten yours. I said that no one would ever invent such a preposterous name. And I said you can forget everything, but you never forget your name. Count Amashi. That name mean anything to you? Or Catherine Clifton?
The room dissolves to a bustling Egyptian marketplace where Catherine Clifton carries a woven throw rug. Browsing a box of old books, Count Almashi notices her.
How much did you pay?
Hello.
They don't see foreign women in this market. How much did you pay?
£7-8, I suppose.
Which store?
Why?
You've been cheated. Now, don't worry, we'll take it back.
I don't want to take it back.
This is not worth £8, Mrs. Clifton.
Just to me.
Did you bargain?
I don't care to bargain.
That insults them.
A smile hardens on her face.
I don't believe that. I think that you're insulted by me somehow.
I'd be very happy to obtain the correct price for this. I apologize if I appear abrupt. I'm rusty at social graces.
She meets his intense gaze and he looks away. His blue eyes soften.
How do you find Cairo? Did you visit the pyramids?
Excuse me.
Or the Sphinx?
Later, Almashi and his colleagues in an elegant bar.
Latitude 2533, longitude 2516.
We attempt to drive northeast of Kufra and leave our bones in the desert.
Jeffrey walks in.
Disagree.
You're Hungarian.
Good evening.
You disagree. Good evening.
How is your charming wife?
Marvellous. She's in love with the hotel plumbing. She's either in the swimming pool, she swims for hours, she's a fish, quite incredible. Or she's in the bath. Actually, she's just outside.
Maddox knits his brow.
Chaps only in the long bar.
Maddox leads his tuxedo-clad colleagues into an airy lounge where Catherine reads a book.
Mrs. Clifton.
She smiles at Maddox.
You'll have to forgive us. We're not accustomed to the company of women.
Not at all. I was thoroughly enjoying my book.
Jeffrey takes her arm.
The team is in mourning, darling.
Oh, really?
I'm afraid we're not having much luck obtaining funds for the expedition.
Oh. Well, what'll you do?
A more modest expedition. Or even wait here.
It's a disaster.
Remind our families we still exist.
Yeah.
Heavens, are you married, Maddox?
Very much so.
We all are.
Save my friend Almashi here. Yeah?
Oh, I feel much better, don't you, darling? You're feeling rather self-conscious. Well, let's toast, then. Absent wives.
Absent wives. And present ones.
And future ones.
Almashi austerely sips his champagne. Later in the ballroom, Catherine dances with D'Agostino. As they spin in tight circles, her flowing white gown swirls around her ankles. He twirls her away, then turns under her dangling hand.
Thank you.
Almashi approaches.
May I?
He lifts Catherine's hand and guides her slowly across the floor. In the lounge, Jeffrey glimpses them and takes a sip of champagne. Swaying in Almashi's formal embrace, Catherine smiles.
Why did you follow me yesterday?
I'm sorry, what?
After the market, you followed me to the hotel.
I was concerned for a woman in that part of Cairo, a European woman, and I felt obliged to.
You felt obliged to?
As the wife of one of our party.
So why follow me? Escort me, by all means, but follow me is predatory, isn't it?
Her smile fades under his lingering gaze. Catherine looks away as his unblinking eyes burn into her. Their bodies sway inches apart. Almashi wears his sandy hair rakishly slicked back. Catherine's curls softly under her bare shoulders. With his hand poised in the small of her back, they glide through the crowd. The dance dissolves slowly to the patient Almashi's dark room in the monastery. Fading couples coast over his chest, then disappear. Hannah sleeps with her arm draped across his chest. She twitches and he winces.
Could I ask you to move? I'm sorry, but I...
Oh, I'm sorry. Chris.
It's just when you move.
Stupid.
I can't really bear the pressure on the...
You all right? I was dreaming. Awful.
Hannah slides her hand to her forehead and, closing her tired eyes, cradles her head in her palm. Later, Hannah carries a lantern into the kitchen, casting its light onto a pitcher and a basin. She pours water into the white enamel basin. She unclasps her dress at the back of her neck and lets it slide off her left shoulder. Scooping water from the basin into her hands, she cools her chest and shoulders. She splashes water onto her face and rubs her weary eyes. She snatches the pitcher and pours water over the back of her neck and through her short dark hair. Hannah sinks into a chair and lays her head on her arm as Caravaggio opens the door behind her.
Hannah.
He touches her shoulders.
Hannah, are you all right?
Leave me alone.
Caravaggio bends down to her. Then he backs away from Hannah's slumped form. Caravaggio pours himself a glass of water from the pitcher. Wearing a tank top undershirt, he stretches his neck and goes to the window. The soft lantern light accentuates his lean, muscular torso.
You're in love with him, aren't you? Your poor patient. You think he's a saint because of the way he looks? I don't think he is.
I'm not in love with him. I'm in love with ghosts. So is he. He's in love with ghosts.
What if I told you he did this to me?
He lifts his gloved, thumbless hands.
How could he have? When?
I'm one of his ghosts, and he wouldn't even know it.
I don't know what that means.
Ask your saint who he is. Ask him who he's killed.
Please, don't creep around this house.
See, I don't think he's forgotten anything. I think he wants to forget.
Now, at Almashi's desert camp.
Gentlemen, to map-making.
To map-making.
And a special thank you to Jeffrey and Catherine, without whose fundraising heroics we'd still be kicking our heels.
To arm-twisting.
Arm-twisting. Did Catherine say... Jeffrey has to fly back to Cairo.
Return the favor. Take a few photographs for the army.
What kind of photographs?
Portraits. The brigadier. Brigadier's wife. Brigadier's dog. Brigadier by the pyramids. Brigadier breathing. And I shall, of course, be bereft. But finally able to explore the Cairo nightlife. I shall produce an authoritative guide to the zinc bars and... I'd say harems. We're in the right country for harems.
Harem.
The next morning, the Cliftons embrace outside their tent.
Bye, my love.
Keep safe. I'll
catch up in a week.
Almashi sits wrapped in a blanket.
Clifton. Safe journey.
You too. Good luck.
Glad the funds have turned up.
Clifton.
Almashi throws off the blanket and walks with Jeffrey to his plane.
It's probably none of my business. Your wife. Do you think it's appropriate to leave her?
Appropriate?
Well, the desert is. It's for a woman. It's very tough. I wonder if it's not too much for her.
Are you mad? Catherine loves it here. She told me yesterday.
All the same, were I you...
I've known Catherine since she was three. We're practically brother and sister before we were man and wife. I think I'd know what is and what isn't too much for it. I think she'd know herself.
Very well.
Why are you people so threatened by a woman?
With a slight grin, Jeffrey swaggers to the Rupert Bear. Almashi turns back to the tents where Catherine stands, staring across the sand at them. In the monastery, Hannah fingers dusty piano keys. She stops and throws back a heavy tarp from the piano, which lies tilted on broken legs. Behind her, the sky shows through a section of the collapsed library wall. Hannah kneels among scattered books and rubble. In the frescoed room, Caravaggio prepares a syringe. Almashi watches Caravaggio inject himself.
I have come to love that little tap of the fingernail against the syringe. Tap.
Caravaggio tenses his bicep.
Tap.
Shuddering, Caravaggio rubs the crook of his arm. In the library, Hannah's fingers dance across the dusty keys. Behind her, outside the rubble-filled room, a soldier wearing a turban runs up a hill. He stands outside the collapsed wall and aims his pistol skyward.
Stop playing! Please, stop playing!
The Indian sapper hurries to a door and rattles its handle.
I don't have the key to that door yet.
She points to the gaping hole in the wall, and he climbs inside.
The Germans were here. The
Germans were all over this area. They left mines everywhere. And pianos were their favorite hiding places.
I see. Sorry.
She steps back. The sapper examines the piano's curves with his fingers.
Then maybe you're safe as long as you only play Bach. He's German?
She smiles.
Is something funny?
No, I'm sorry.
She covers her mouth and looks away. As the sapper's hands run along the crooked piano, Hannah watches with bright, smiling eyes. He lifts a small lid, revealing the hinged keyboard cover. Glancing inside, he moves on.
I've met you before.
I don't think so.
He glides his fingertips under the front of the piano. He drops to his stomach and Hannah's smile twitches. The sapper points to a wire and two sticks of dynamite.
Look. See? Move that and no more Bach.
Lieutenant! Are you all right, sir?
Fine, Sergeant.
So you're working with the Italians?
Yeah, trying to get them to give up their weapons.
Later, from her patient's room, Hannah watches the sappers set up camp in a courtyard.
He wants us to move out. He says there could be 50 more mines in the building. He thinks I'm mad because I laugh at him. He's Indian. He wears a turban.
No, he's Sikh. If he wears a turban, he's Sikh.
I'll probably marry him.
Really? That's sudden.
My mother always told me I would summon my husband by playing the piano.
She lays a damp cloth on Almashi's chest and gently presses it to his coarse, scarred skin.
I liked it better when they were just the two of us.
Why? Is he staying?
With his sergeant, Mr. Hardy.
We should charge. Doesn't anyone have a job to do?
They have to clear all the roads of mines. That's a big job.
In that case, I suppose we can't charge.
No, we can't.
She continues washing him. Daytime. The Indian lieutenant and his ruddy-faced sergeant drive motorcycles past the monastery garden, where Hannah plants a row of lettuce. The Indian spots her, and Hannah looks up. She lifts her hand in a tentative wave, too late as the motorcycles round a bend. A makeshift wind chime of broken cups, glass, and china dangles over the garden. Hannah studies her disheveled reflection in a jagged sliver of mirror. In the frescoed room, Almashi lies on his side. His gnarled form dissolves into the desert, where the expedition's three supply-laden trucks follow a shallow rut in the sand. Almashi drives the lead truck, with Catherine beside him, and an Egyptian perched on the roof.
I've been thinking, how does someone like you decide to come to the desert?
What is it? You're doing whatever you're doing in your castle or wherever it is you live, and one day you say, I have to go to the desert, or what?
I once traveled with a guide who was taking me to fire. He didn't speak for 9 hours. At the end of it, he pointed at the horizon and said, fire. That was a good day.
His gaze remains fixed on the desert ahead. With a shake of her blonde curls, Catherine looks out her window.
Actually, you sing.
What?
You sing all the time.
I do not.
Ask hello.
Almashi opens his door and leans out.
Hello!
The Egyptian looks down.
Anna Diamond Rani? The Rani Diamond, Anna?
I'll be down. Grazie in the taxi, honey.
Catherine grins.
I'll be down.
Better be ready about half past eight. Remember, honey, don't be late, because I'll be there when the band starts playing. I'm going to dance off both my shoes when they play the Jelly Roll Blues.
Almashi sneaks a few quick glances at her. Later, at the base of a rugged desert mountain, Alaf closes his eyes.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
Almashi leads the rest of the expedition up through the boulders.
Give me your hand.
He pulls Catherine up. She grins. Later, Al-Mashi sits alone. He gazes up at a centrally curving sandstone ridge and compares it to the sketch in his book.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
Al-Auf and the other Egyptians kneel and lower their heads to the sand. Al-Mashi shoulders his backpack and hikes alone, climbing a pass toward the curved ridge. He stops at a boulder and studies five grooves worn into its surface. He carefully slides his left hand into the grooves, perfectly matching the hand-shaped impression. He wiggles his fingers, then scans the sheer rock wall surrounding him. Climbing down a few steps, Al-Mashi approaches the dark opening to a cave. He retrieves a battery lantern from his backpack, switches it on, and begins a gently sloped descent into the cave. He travels through a natural corridor, his light revealing a floor of smooth, rounded stones. Walking along a ledge in a massive open room, he stops. As Al-Mashi moves his light across the overhanging wall, his eyes widen, and a grin of delight spreads across his face. The shadowy light deepens the creases in his thin, handsome face. He turns and runs.
Maddox!
Maddox scrambles up the rocks toward the cave.
Come quickly, I found something!
What is it?
Jack! Marvin! Quick!
Later, light beams sweep across a cave wall covered with paintings, the simple brushstrokes depicting human figures. Some of the figures stand, others crouch with bows. Maddox studies several horizontal figures, depicted with scissored legs and forward-reaching arms.
My God. Swimming.
Maddox studies their curved bodies and fluid limbs.
They're swimming.
The cave wall dissolves to a sheet of coarse ochre paper. A paintbrush's ink-soaked tip gently caresses the paper, filling in the curved torso of a swimmer in mid-stroke. Sitting beneath the arched walls of cave paintings, Catherine works with a portable easel, copying the images under an electric lamp. Al-Auf carries a basket of artifacts outside, passing Al-Mashi, who enters the cave. Inside, a fresh-faced Egyptian bangs his head on the low ceiling. Standing nearby, Berman cradles the young man's head in his chest and offers a tender smile. He grips the Egyptian's arm, then glances up at Al-Mashi, who watches them. Later, Al-Mashi rides in Berman's truck. Kamal, the young Egyptian who banged his head, rides shotgun on the roof. Kamal swings his face down to the open window, and Berman teases him with an orange slice, then feeds Kamal and caresses his face. Al-Mashi blinks away his stare, and Berman's smile fades.
How do you explain to someone who has never been here feelings which seem quite normal?
I don't know, my friend.
He grips Berman's arm.
I don't know.
They smile. Kamal leans down to Berman's window, but slips and falls off the roof.
Oh, Kamal!
Berman, what are you doing?
The truck swerves and veers over a steep sand dune. The truck rolls over and over, tumbling downhill through the sand. The second truck plows after them. The last truck stops. Maddox and Catherine leap out and race down to Al-Mashi's truck, now resting on its side.
Let me help!
Al-Mashi, are you all right?
Yes, I'm fine.
Two assistants pull Fuad from the second truck.
My wrist!
Later, the men push the second truck, its radiator bent and smashed. Catherine helps bandage Berman. Later still, Catherine and Maddox sit in the only working truck. Al-Mashi comes to the window.
I'll be back as quick as I can. 36 hours at the outside.
Try to get an additional radiator. We can store it between here and Pottery Hill. And a better jack. We planned badly.
Berman?
Berman, his wrist bandaged, stands with Kamal. The Egyptian bows apologetically, and Berman swings a gentle punch at his chin. Grinning, Berman climbs into the back of the truck.
Save Jenny.
The tires falter in deep sand ruts.
Now what?
The passengers unload.
Let's get all this stuff off.
I'll stay behind, of course.
Certainly not.
I caused the problem, I should stay.
You can't. None of you
can. No, I insist. There clearly isn't room for all of us. I'm the least able to dig, and I'm not one of the walking wounded. There's only one knife. Besides, if I remain, it's the most effective method of persuading my husband to abandon whatever he's doing and come and rescue us.
All right. Come on, let's get going.
Maddox hops in the truck. The Egyptians and injured men push it from behind. Almashi joins in, and the truck struggles out of the ruts. Almashi waves to his departing colleagues, then fires a narrow-eyed glare at Catherine, who saunters down the sand dune. He nervously looks away, then glowers in the low golden sunlight. Later, while the Egyptians make camp, Catherine studies her ink sketches of the cave swimmers. She wears a red shawl draped over her khaki field outfit and white blouse. She walks past the cooking fire to Almashi's tarp, where he sits wrapped in a blanket, writing in his leather-bound book. Catherine holds out her postcard-sized renderings.
I thought you might like to paste them into your book.
Almashi hesitantly takes them. Catherine smiles as he looks them over.
Well, we took photographs.
With a polite smile, he holds them out.
There's no need.
No, really, I'd like you to have them.
Well, there is really no need. This is just a scrapbook. They're too good. I should feel obliged. Thank you.
Catherine blinks at him and takes back her paintings. Almashi returns to his writing. Catherine starts back toward the overturned truck, stops, and looks at Almashi with a slight smile.
And that would be unconscionable, I suppose, wouldn't it? To feel any obligation.
Almashi's eyes flit away, then back to her.
Yes, of course it would.
Glaring, she whirls around and strides across the sand to her truck. Almashi, his face tanned and stubbled, watches her briefly. His gaze flutters and finally returns to his book. That night, Catherine sits cross-legged alone on a dune. Wrapped in her shawl, she studies the stars above her. Below, the men pack supplies into the broken trucks. Almashi notices Catherine silhouetted by her cigarette smoke and climbs up to her.
You should come into the shelter.
I'm quite all right, thank you.
Look over there.
What am I looking at?
Do you see what's happening to them, the stars?
They're so untidy, I was trying to rearrange them.
No. Over there.
Along the dark horizon, a wall of sand billows up from the dunes.
In a few minutes, there'll be no stars. The air is filling with sand.
Catherine watches the growing sand clouds veil the night sky. In the raging sandstorm, shadowy figures lash tarps over the back of a pickup truck. They wear cloths bound around their heads and faces. One of the figures climbs into the upright truck and someone slams the door shut. The others struggle against the wind and sand. They climb onto the second truck, which lies on its side. Three of them descend into the cab, and a lone figure closes the door above them. We glimpse a flashlight tied to the man's waist. Alone, he stumbles, swallowed by the storm. He staggers to his feet and snatches a bag from the ground. Inside the upright truck, Catherine sits wrapped in her shawl. The door opens and sand whips into the cab. The man gets in and yanks the door shut. Stripping the cloth from his face, Almashi opens a canteen and offers Catherine water.
This is not very good, is it?
No.
They clear their eyes with dampened cloths.
Will we be all right?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Yes is a comfort. Absolutely is not.
Outside, a tarp flails in a storm. Its cords slacken, loosing it to the wind. Sand spills down the dune, piling against the door of their truck. Inside, Catherine traces her fingers across the window.
Let me tell you about winds. There is a whirlwind from southern Morocco, the Ajej, against which the Fellahin defend themselves with knives. And there is the Ghibli from Tunis.
The Ghibli?
The Ghibli, which rolls and rolls and rolls and produces a rather strange nervous condition. And then there is the Harmattan, a red wind, which mariners call the Sea of Darkness. And red sand from this wind has flown as far as the south coast of England, apparently producing showers so dense that they were mistaken for blood.
Fiction. We have a house on that coast, and it has never, never rained blood.
No, it's all true. Herodotus, your friend.
My friend.
He writes about it. And he writes about...
He strokes her hair.
A wind, the Simoon, which a nation thought was so evil, they declared war on it and marched out against it in full battle dress. Their swords raised.
Catherine presses her fingertips against the glass. The blowing sand dissolves to Almashi's scarred, ashen face. He lies in the dark, frescoed room, his chest rising with each breath. Now, in the desert, morning sunlight reveals one pickup truck half buried at the base of the dune.
Catherine, I need to get out of your side quick.
He kicks the door open.
Of course, sorry.
They climb out.
Ridiculous to fall asleep. Unforgivable. Damn the flare!
Catherine spots a truck in the distance.
Stop! Over here!
She waves her hands.
Stop!
Almashi brings the flare gun.
Maddox! Maddox!
The flare sails in a tremendous arc over the endless sea of sand, passing hundreds of feet behind Maddox's truck. The truck disappears behind a far-off dune, and Catherine studies the wind-traced sands.
Our tracks have disappeared.
And Maddox will calculate how many miles he'll soon turn around.
Catherine scans the horizon with tired, squinting eyes. Almashi turns to her.
Could I ask you, please, to paste your paintings into my book? I should like to have them. I should be honored.
Catherine's eyes narrow in a questioning stare.
The others!
He runs.
Oh, God.
Quick!
Almashi grabs a shovel and digs into a depression in the sand.
Oh, how awful. We've got to get them out.
Quick, get the other shovel.
Catherine falls to her knees and digs with him.
Am I a terrible coward to ask how much water we have left?
A little in our can. We have water in the radiator, which can be drunk, and it's not cowardly at all. It's extremely practical. Come on.
He digs 2 feet deep.
There's also a plant. I've never seen it, but I believe you can cut a piece the size of a heart from this plant, and the next morning it'll be filled with a delicious liquid.
Find that plant. Cut out its heart.
Almashi staggers as he starts a new hole.
Here.
Together they scoop away handfuls of sand.
Here's the window. Clear the glass. I'll clear the door. Mind your hands.
Okay, we're here.
They glimpse a face in the buried window and dig harder.
Hang on. Coming.
They clear the sand to the edges of the door and Almashi lifts it open. The Egyptians reach out of the truck.
Oh, alhamdulillah.
I've got it.
Almashi hoists the first man to the surface. Later, the men probe the buried campsite with shovels, moving across the sand in a slow, methodical line. Catherine sits alone in the truck and slips her cave paintings between the pages of Almashi's book. Under the bright desert sun, an Egyptian finds something in the sand.
Hey, hey, come
In the truck, Catherine flips through Almashi's Herodotus, its yellowed pages fat with scraps of paper. She discovers a faded picture of a chubby toddler and gazes up at Almashi. She studies his hawkish, sunburned features. She returns the picture and unfolds a piece of letterhead marked with official seals. Notes, scribbled in black ink, fill the page. A capital letter K appears in every line of the cramped handwriting. Catherine folds the paper along well-worn creases and finds more notes scribbled on the back. A line begins, K's clothes always at ease on her.
Catherine!
Almashi recovers a metal canteen from the sand and holds it up with a grin.
Water.
Catherine beams a smile, then slides the note and another painting into his book. At night, a red flare burns across the black sky. Almashi watches its light and lowers his flare gun. Catherine joins him.
Jeffrey's not in Cairo. He's not actually a buffoon. The plane wasn't a wedding present. It belongs to the British government. They want aerial maps of the whole of North Africa. So I think he's in Ethiopia. In case you're counting on his sudden appearance.
And the marriage. Is that a fiction?
No, the marriage isn't a fiction.
A flare ignites on the horizon.
Maddox. It's Maddox.
The Egyptians jump and wave. Catherine turns to Almashi.
Am I K in your book? I think I must be.
In the fading red glow of Maddox's flare, Almashi faces her, and they stare into each other's eyes. Almashi places the back of his rugged hand under Catherine's jaw and gently slides his fingers down her slender neck. Now, in the monastery, the Indian lieutenant reads to Almashi.
Chapter 1. He sat in defiance of municipal orders astride the gun Zamzamah. I can't read these words. I can't read them. They stick in my throat.
Because you're reading it too fast.
Not at all.
You have to read Kipling slowly. Your eye is too impatient. Think about the speed of his pen. What is it? He sat, comma, in defiance of municipal orders, comma, astride the gun, Zamzamah, on her brick... What is it?
Brick platform, opposite the old Ajib Gir.
The Wonder House, comma, as the natives called the Lahore Museum.
It's still there, the cannon, outside the museum. It was made of metal cups and bowls taken from every household in the city as tax, then melted down. Then later they fired the cannon at my people. Comma. The natives. Full stop.
Almashi sips through a straw.
What exactly is it you object to the writer or what he's writing about?
What I really object to, Uncle, is you're finishing all my condensed milk. And the message everywhere in your book, however slowly I read it, that the best thing for India is to be ruled by the British.
Hannah, we've discovered a shared pleasure, the boy and I.
Arguing about books.
Condensed milk, one of the truly great inventions.
I'll get another tin.
I didn't like that book either. It's all about man. Too many men. Just like this house.
You like him, don't you? Your voice changes.
No, I don't think it does. Anyway... Is indifferent to me?
I don't think it's indifference.
He returns.
Hannah was just telling me you were indifferent.
Hey!
To her cooking.
Well, I'm indifferent to cooking, not Hannah's cooking in particular. Have either of you tried condensed milk sandwiches? They're very good with salt.
He taps the tin of condensed milk. Now, in an outdoor market, a man in a caftan tunic carries a rug on his shoulder. A black taxicab passes through, then continues down a tree-lined street to the Shepherd's Hotel. A bellhop wearing a brown fez holds the door open for Catherine.
Welcome back, madam.
Almashi gets out and hands a valise to another bellhop. Still dressed in his dusty shorts and shirt, Almashi lingers at the bottom of the stairs while Catherine climbs to the hotel entrance. She smiles down at him.
Can you not come in?
No. I should go home.
Will you please come in?
Mrs. Clifton.
Don't.
She turns her back.
I believe you still have my book.
Catherine cracks a tight smile and looks through her bag. Almashi climbs the stairs, his piercing blue eyes locked on her. Catherine holds the book out at arm's length.
Thank you.
With a tight smile, Catherine turns her back and walks into the hotel. Almashi watches her for a moment, then walks down the stairs. Now, in a room, a valise sits open on the floor, rumpled clothes hanging half out. On a neatly made bed, Almashi sleeps face down in his desert shorts and shirt. He lies still, sprawled on top of the woven bedspread, his face just shy of the pillow. Almashi stirs and pushes himself up. Turning his dusty face, his eyes widen. Catherine strolls through the doorway, wearing a white cotton dress, its high waistline fitted under her bosom. Almashi takes in her sun-edged form, her blonde sideswept hair pulled back, her smooth face and pink lips impassive. Almashi stands and slowly approaches her. Catherine raises her right hand and slaps him. Almashi falls to his knees, desperately hugging Catherine's waist as her blows fall on his shoulders and back. Groping, he looks up at her. Catherine strokes his hair with her fingers.
You still have sand in your hair.
Almashi touches her face and Catherine bends to her knees. They embrace with deep, frantic kisses. Almashi grabs the neckline of her dress and rips it open. He grazes over her slim breast, then hungrily kisses her neck. Catherine falls backward. Later, Catherine lies in bed. She watches Almashi sitting in his tub, hand sewing her white dress.
Wouldn't be make-believe if you believe in me without your love.
I'm impressed you can sew.
Good.
He pushes the needle through. Catherine, wearing Almashi's caftan, perches on the edge of the bathtub.
So very badly.
Well, you don't sew at all.
A woman should never learn to sew, and if she can, she shouldn't admit to it.
Catherine runs her fingers through his short hair, then pours a bowl of bathwater over his head.
Close your eyes.
Makes it harder still.
He grins and puts down the dress as Catherine pours shampoo onto his scalp. She massages it through his hair.
When were you most happy?
Now.
And when were you least happy?
Now.
Almashi's face tenses as she cleans sand from his ear.
What do you love?
What do I love?
Say everything.
Let's see. Water. Fish in it. Hedgehogs. Hedgehogs.
And what else?
Marmite. I'm addicted.
She disrobes and slides in behind him.
And baths. Not with other people.
Almashi leans back into her arms.
Islands. Your handwriting.
Their lips meet in slow, wet kisses.
Go on all day.
Go on all day.
Lying against her shoulder, he gazes into her eyes. Catherine pulls away and stares distantly.
a husband.
What do you hate most?
A lie. What do you hate most?
Ownership. Being owned. When you leave, you should forget me.
His gaze wanders across the room, then settles on her eyes. Catherine pushes his head off her shoulder. She climbs out of the tub, water dripping from her slender nude body. She takes her white dress from the floor and walks out. Almashi sinks back into the water and strokes his face with his hands. In the monastery, Hannah finds Almashi's baby picture in Herodotus.
Who is this?
Don't you recognize me?
Is it you? So fat.
Hannah finds a note written on a scrap of red foil and green paper.
That's a Christmas cracker. Firecracker.
This is in your handwriting, is it?
Yes, it is.
December 22nd. Betrayals in war are childlike compared with our betrayals during peace. New lovers are nervous and tender, but smash everything. For the heart is an organ of fire. For the heart is an organ of fire. I love that. I believe that.
She looks at the note.
Kay. Who is Kay?
Kay. It's for Catherine.
Now, in a courtyard, Catherine carries a teapot past tables full of soldiers. From inside, Almashi watches a costumed Santa Claus deliver gifts to the troops. Almashi waves a Christmas cracker at Catherine, and she comes to his window.
Say you're sick.
They pulled the cracker.
What? No.
Say you're feeling faint. The heat.
No.
I can't work.
He dons a paper crown.
Can't sleep.
Catherine!
A woman holds up a teacup.
Coming.
She turns back to Almashi.
I can't sleep. I woke up shouting in the middle of the night. Jeffrey thinks it's the thing in the desert. Trauma.
I can still taste you.
Catherine's eyes smolder. She turns to a woman in the courtyard.
Philippa, this is empty.
I'm trying to write with your taste in my mouth.
An ardent smile plays across her lips.
Swoon. I'll catch you.
He watches Catherine return to the party. The Santa, costumed in a red suit and long white beard, leads some children out of the courtyard. Inside, Almashi starts a note on the cracker paper. Betrayals in war. Someone raises a glass.
Merry Christmas, everyone!
Catherine slumps.
Catherine, oh my goodness!
Oh.
Fetch a chair.
No, I'm fine.
It's this heat. It's terrible. She's all right. She's quite all right.
Good.
Are you pregnant?
I didn't think so, no.
How romantic. With Fiona, I fell over every 5 minutes. Ronnie christened me Lady Downfall.
Do you know, I think I might go inside and sit down for a few minutes.
I'll come with you.
No, I'll be all right. You stay here.
Are you sure?
The lady shrugs and grins girlishly at another guest as Catherine walks out of the courtyard. Inside, Almashi takes Catherine's hand and leads her through a storeroom's low doorway. Around a corner, by some pantry shelves, they stop and eye each other. As Almashi's long fingers unpin her Christmas corsage, Catherine slowly lowers the side zipper of her white dress. With his lips parted, Almashi meets her even gaze. Carefully, he places his hand inside the open zipper, then firmly pulls Catherine toward him. Above a choker of pearls, perspiration shines in the deep hollow of her slender throat. Lowering his face, he tastes her sheen with his outstretched tongue. His hands lower the satin straps of her underclothes from her fine-boned shoulder. As he strokes her silky skin, their eyes meet. Almasi gathers the hem of Catherine's white slip and slides his hand beneath her dress. Catherine's chest heaves at his touch. Her eyes droop shut. In the courtyard, Maddox and Fouad sing along with the enlisted men. Behind a kilted bagpiper, shapes rock behind a frosted glass window. Behind the storeroom window, the lovers cling to each other. Almashi presses his thumb into Catherine's panting mouth. She sucks it hungrily, then bites hard, her neck arched against the pantry shelves. Almashi lifts her. Catherine braces against the wall. Her open mouth gasps for breath, then devours his lips in a kiss. Desperately, she hooks his neck in her arm, then buries her face in his shoulder. In the courtyard, the soldiers raise their cups.
Happy Christmas!
Inside, the costumed Santa Claus strides through a hallway. He stops Almashi as he passes.
Have you seen Catherine?
What?
It's Clifton under here.
Oh, no, I haven't. Sorry.
Jeffrey pulls off his red hood, then hurries away. Around another corner, he spots his wife.
Darling, just heard.
She sits, curled on a corner window seat.
Oh, sausage, you all right?
I'm fine, it's too hot.
Lady H thought you might be pregnant.
I'm not pregnant, just hot. Too hot. Like you.
It's sweltering, actually.
He removes his false beard and pillow stuffing.
Come on, I'll take you home.
Can't we really go home? Are you dying for green, anything green, rain? It's Christmas, is all.
Her chin quivers as she looks at Jeffrey with puffy eyes.
If you asked me, I'd go home tomorrow, if you wanted.
Darling, you know we can't go home. There might be a war.
Smiling tightly, she ruffles the fur of his Santa costume.
Oh, Jeffrey, you do so love a disguise.
I do so love you.
He squeezes beside her and wraps her in his arms.
What do you smell of?
What?
Catherine turns away.
Marzipan. I think you got marzipan in your hand. No wonder you're homesick.
She slides off the seat, leaving Jeffrey frowning curiously. As she leaves the room, he gathers the bits of his costume and follows. Now, at the monastery, the patient Almashi's chest rises and falls with labored breaths. Caravaggio juts his sharp nose toward the scarred man.
Is it you?
What?
If I said moose.
Moose? What the hell's moose?
I look different. Why shouldn't you?
Standing slowly, he steps away to the foot of the bed.
I heard your breathing. I thought it was the rain. I'm dying for rain. I'm dying anyway. But I long for the rain on my face.
First wedding anniversary. What do you call it?
I don't know. Paper? Is it? I don't know. Paper. Paper?
Darling, it's me. Listen, I'm sorry.
In an office, Jeffrey marks a wall map and talks on the phone.
I'm going to sulk, and I'm not moving till you get back here.
Promise? That's good. Okay, my sausage, I love you.
Rupert, a man at another desk, looks up from his work.
Didn't know you were going anywhere.
No. You're going to surprise her. It's our anniversary. She's forgotten, of course. What's the symbol of your first anniversary? I should get something. Is it cotton or paper?
First anniversary? But you two have been married for donkey's years.
Been friends for donkey's years. Best friends. She was always crying on my shoulder about somebody. Finally persuaded her to settle for my shoulder. Stroke of genius.
Jeffrey calls into another office.
Moose, are you there?
Yes.
First anniversary, is that Cotton?
Is what Cotton?
Caravaggio.
First wedding anniversary.
Your first anniversary is paper.
Pinching a cigarette between his thumb and forefinger, Caravaggio returns to his office. Later, Catherine jogs out of the Shepherd Hotel. In an approaching cab, Jeffrey holds a wrapped bouquet.
Stop!
His face brightens, please? Then falls.
Stop here.
Here?
Stop right here.
Yes, sir.
As Jeffrey's driver parks beside the curb, Catherine gets into another cab a few cars ahead. Later in Almashi's room, golden sunlight filters through the bed curtain over Catherine's nude body. She sleeps with one arm stretched across an empty pillow and the other folded across her breasts. Almashi, in his caftan, puts a record on a phonograph. Catherine's eyes slowly open. She closes them again and smiles.
This, what is this?
It's a folk song.
Arabic.
No, it's Hungarian. My Dojka sang it to me when I was a child growing up in Budapest.
Joining her on the bed, he leans back against the pillows and tenderly strokes her hand.
It's beautiful. It's
Tibet. Salalam means love. And the story, well, there's this Hungarian count. He's a wanderer, he's a fool. And for years he's on some kind of a quest for who knows what. And then one day he falls under the spell of a mysterious English woman, a harpy, who beats him and hits him, and he becomes her slave, and he sews her clothes.
Catherine pummels him on the head.
Stop it. Oh, it's beating me.
You bastard, I believed you. You should be my slave.
She lies on her stomach and gazes at him. With limp fingers, he traces a circle on her skin.
I claim this shoulder blade. No, wait. I want...
Rolling her over, he touches the notch of her throat.
This place.
He presses it with his middle finger.
I love this place. What's it called?
Catherine's skin pulses beneath his touch.
This is mine. I'm going to ask the king permission to call it the Almashi Bosphorus.
I thought we were against ownership.
Almashi stares under long lashes into Catherine's dancing blue eyes.
I can stay tonight.
She blinks, then turns her face away. Almashi relaxes into his pillow.
Maddox knows, I think. He keeps talking about Anna Karenina. I think it's his idea of a man-to-man chat. Well, it's my idea of a man-to-man chat.
She playfully nudges him. Then her smile fades.
This is a different world, is what I tell myself. Different life. And here I'm a different wife.
She looks at him while he glances over her unclothed body.
Yeah, you are a different wife.
Catherine draws herself to Almashi's side and presses her lips to his. She embraces him. Nighttime. Outside the hotel, Jeffrey's hired car still waits at the curb. In the back seat, he guzzles from a champagne bottle, dribbling froth down his chin. He tears a folded strip of paper, then unfolds it to reveal a row of torn-out hearts. The following day, Almashi and Catherine stroll in the market.
They're darling. What are they? Thimbles?
Yes, they're quite old.
She picks one up.
It's full of saffron, just in case you think I'm going to give it to you to encourage your sewing.
The merchant holds out his hand. Almashi pays him, then cocks his head at Catherine.
I don't care to bargain.
That day, did you follow me to the market?
Yes, of course.
He continues walking. Catherine grips his arm and he turns around, eyeing her with a grave stare.
Shall we be all right?
Yes. Yes.
He walks on, then shows her a soft smile.
Absolutely.
Oh, dear.
They walk up stone steps, leading out of the market and onto the street above. Almashi briefly takes Catherine's hand behind her back and stops on the stairs. Squeezing his fingers, she strolls away without looking back. Outside the hotel, Jeffrey leans on the cab's front seat and exhales a stream of cigarette smoke. His vacant gaze focuses as Catherine enters the hotel's gates. Jeffrey holds his forehead.
And my heart beats so that I can hardly breathe.
Now, in the monastery, Caravaggio spins records on a phonograph. Almashi turns his face toward him.
Thought you'd never wake up.
What?
Where did you find that?
I liberated it.
I think that's called looting.
No one should own music. The real question is, who wrote the song?
Irving Berlin.
For?
Top Hat.
Is there a song you don't know?
Nope. He sings all the time.
She kisses Almashi's forehead.
Did you know that? You're always singing.
I've been told before.
Kip's another one.
Hannah looks outside at the sapper lieutenant, billeted in the courtyard.
Wang Wang Blues.
You're incredible.
By his tent, Kip unwinds his turban cloth, revealing his top knot of hair. Later, Hannah passes his sergeant, Hardy.
Good morning, miss.
Hello. You saved my life. I haven't forgotten. I thought you were very, very tall. You seem so big and giant. I feel like a child who can't keep a balance.
A toddler.
Hardy continues on his way with a waddling, trampish gait. Hannah, in her flowered dress and tennis shoes, carries a small bowl out to the courtyard. Behind a cloth, hung up as a curtain, Kip bends over a basin, bare-chested and wearing khaki uniform pants.
My hair was long at some point.
Kip straightens, flipping his waist-length hair down his back.
I've forgotten what a nuisance it is to wash.
She hands him the palm-sized bowl.
Try this. I found a great jar of it. Olive oil.
Thank you.
He holds the bowl in one hand and wrings his hair with the other. Hannah trots away, and Kip stares at the oil, then after her.
Is this for my hair?
Yes, for your hair.
He smiles down at it, then reaches for his shirt. Later, Caravaggio and Almashi listen to the phonograph.
There was a general who wore a patch over a perfectly good eye. The men fought harder for him.
Caravaggio sits against the far wall, tapping his foot to the music.
Sometimes I think I could get up and dance. What's under your mittens?
The thief sways with his eyes closed. A liquor bottle and glass sit beside him.
What's under your mittens?
Caravaggio grips the cuff of one fingerless glove in his teeth. Now civilians burn file folders in a metal drum. A title appears, Tobruk, June 1942. As Caravaggio strides into a ransacked office, a secretary interrupts his hurried pace.
He's waiting for you. I see you tonight.
A British general.
Look, Moose. We need you to stay in Tobruk. I know it's a bit of a short straw, but Jerry's got our maps, you know. Now they're getting the spies into Cairo using our maps. They get Rommel into Cairo using our maps. The whole of the desert's like a bloody bus route, and we gave it to them. Any foreigner who turned up, welcome to the Royal Geographic. Take our maps. Old Maddox went mad with it. The Genopi, the Maddox.
Yeah.
Magnificent explorer. Thanks, Archer. After he found out he'd been betrayed by Al Massey, his best friend, absolutely destroyed the poor sod.
Outside, paratroopers descend from the sky. Muslim women veiled in black cloaks watch a column of panzer tanks roll into the city. Captured British troops walk under guard in the opposite direction. In the harbor, black smoke curls above the decks of burning ships. In a courtyard, citizens stand in lines before German officers seated at wooden tables. Caravaggio waits as a German gestures to a woman and child at the head of his line.
Nächste bitte. Soll das ein arabisches Kind sein?
Ja.
Das ist doch ein englisches Kind.
He gestures at the boy.
Hallo, little Tommy.
A soldier drags the battered secretary between the lines.
British friend?
She falls, catching Caravaggio's eye, but he looks away. Stepping out of line, he walks calmly to the rear of the crowd.
I don't have a boyfriend.
The German spots him and aims his Luger. The crowd ducks, leaving Caravaggio standing unsteadily. Later, in a basement interrogation room, a chain shackles Caravaggio's wrists to a table. A German officer holds photos of him.
David Caravaggio.
No.
This was taken in Cairo at British headquarters, July 41. And so was this, August 41. And this, February 42.
It's possible. I was buying or selling something. I've been to Cairo many times.
You are a Canadian spy working for the Allies. Codename Moose.
Ja, hallo?
Einen Moment, bitte.
Herr Major? Nochmal das Hauptquartier.
Ja?
Can you get me a doctor?
I'm sick.
Ich weiß nicht, warum.
I'm leaking blood.
Er sagt, er braucht einen Arzt.
You want a doctor?
I've been asking for weeks, months, I don't know.
We don't have a doctor.
Es gibt oben eine Krankenschwester.
But we do have a nurse.
Sure, great. A nurse would be great.
Lassen Sie das und holen Sie die Krankenschwester.
Look, give me something. Name, a code. So we can all get out of this room.
Guards stand against the dark-stained walls behind Caravaggio.
It's too hot.
I slept with a girl. I've got a wife in Tripoli.
A stenographer types.
A girl comes up and points at you. You only see trouble.
Caravaggio stares as a young nurse enters in a spotless white uniform.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do. This is your nurse, by the way. She's Muslim.
So she'll understand all of this.
What's the punishment for adultery? Let's leave it at that. You're married and you were fucking another woman, so that's a...
Caravaggio's gaunt face trembles.
Is it the hands that I cut off? Or is that for stealing? Does anyone know?
Well, you must know. You were brought up in Libya, yes?
Don't cut me.
Or was it to write? 10 fingers.
Yeah. How about this? You give me a name for every finger. It doesn't matter who. I get something, you keep something.
I'm trying to be reasonable.
Don't cut me, come on.
The officer glances at the stenographer who waits, his fingers poised.
Our thumb's fingers?
He looks at the shadow of his own thumb.
Is that down my finger?
His aide, with the phone, holds the receiver to his heaving chest.
I get no help from these people.
Telephone, come on.
I'm sick of this room. I'm sick of this heat. I'm sick of this phone!
The officer turns to the stenographer.
Was machen Sie denn da?
Die Genfer Konvention.
Was?
Die Genfer Konvention. Ich muss doch mitschreiben, was...
Geneva Convention.
Hey, come on!
The officer tears the steno paper, then takes a folding razor from a drawer.
Come over here.
The young nurse obeys, creasing her brow. Two guards seize Caravaggio by the shoulders and hold him down. The recorder closes his stenograph. The officer instructs the nurse by pretending to saw his own thumb.
Oh, please, please, no!
Oh. What name did you say? I knew them!
I can't think of any name!
The nurse grips the razor in her fist.
Jesus Christ! Jesus Christ! No! I
wrenching Caravaggio's left thumb free of his fist, the nurse holds it at the joint. The officer's aide looks away.
Come on!
The nurse presses the blade through the knuckle. Dark blood pours onto the table. Now Caravaggio holds up his thumbless hands.
The man who took my thumbs? I found him eventually. I killed him. The man who took my photograph, I found him too. That took me a year. He's dead.
Another man showed the Germans a way to get their spies into Cairo. I've been looking for him.
A title appears. Cairo, March 1939. In a library, Al-Mashi and Maddox study aerial maps.
We can find a way through the Wadi. We can drive straight into Cairo.
This whole spur is a real possibility.
So on Thursday, you don't trust Bell's map. Bell was a fool. Bell couldn't draw a map. But on Friday, he's suddenly infallible. And where are the expedition maps?
In my room.
Those maps belong to His Majesty's government. They shouldn't be left lying around for any Tom, Dick, or Harry to have sight of.
What on earth's the matter with you?
Don't be so bloody naive. You know there's a war breaking out.
Maddox collects himself, then takes a folded note from his pocket.
This arrived this morning. By order of the British government, all international expeditions to be aborted by May 1939.
Later, they walk through the market.
What do they care about our maps?
What do we find in the desert? Arrowheads, spears. In a war, if you own the desert, you own North Africa.
Own the desert?
Al-Mashi stops.
Maddox, that place. That place at the base of a woman's throat. You know, the hollow here. Does it have an official name?
For God's sake, man. Pull yourself together.
Later, at an outdoor cinema, people sit on bleachers and watch a newsreel. The black and white film flashes a message. Is it peace or war? Catherine stares anxiously through the darkness. On screen, Prime Minister Chamberlain tips his hat.
The answer lies with one man, and the solid mass of the crowd surging round his car are a symbol of the fact that the British people are more firmly of one mind today than at any other time in our history.
Tears streak Catherine's face. Letting out a sigh, she hangs her head. Behind the bleachers, Al-Mashi hurries through the cinema entrance, paying a man as he walks by. He plops down beside Catherine on her bench.
Sorry.
He double takes at her pale, indifferent face.
Go on. Can't do this.
Al-Mashi draws his arm around her.
I can't do this. I can't do this anymore.
Her hardened features collapse into sobs on Almashi's shoulder. Holding her head, he lightly kisses her hair. Later, as chorus girls fill the movie screen, Al-Mashi and Catherine sit on a scaffold support beneath the bleachers. He stares at her, and she stares at the ground.
I better go now.
Standing, she looks down at his burnished face.
Say goodbye here.
I'm not agreeing. Don't think I'm agreeing, because I'm not.
Any minute now, he'll find out. We'll barge into someone. It'll kill him.
Don't go over it again, please.
She pulls away, but he grips her hand tightly and draws her back. Catherine sighs wearily as Al-Mashi opens her palm, then presses his face into it. She takes her arm away.
Catherine.
By the bleacher support, she pauses.
I just want you to know I'm not missing you yet.
She sends him an empty gaze.
You will.
Turning, she smacks her forehead on the scaffolding pole. Al-Mashi starts to his feet, but Catherine keeps walking. Nighttime in the monastery. Al-Mashi strains for breath through his parted lips. On the floor beside the bed, Caravaggio reclines against a bundle of clothes, smoking. Now, in a Cairo ballroom, members of Maddox's expedition sit around a formally set dining table. Al-Mashi stumbles in, weaving drunkenly in his tuxedo.
I believe I'm rather late.
Catherine's face freezes.
We're all here. A toast to the International Sand Club
May it soon resurface.
The International Sand Club. Misfits, buggers, fascists, and fools. God bless us, everyone. Oops. Mustn't say international. Dirty word. Filthy word. His Majesty, Der Führer, Il Duce.
Sorry, what's your point?
Geoffrey.
And the people here don't want us. You must be joking. The Egyptians are desperate to get rid of the colonials. Isn't that right, Fuad? Some of their best people getting down on their hands and knees begging to be spared a knighthood. Isn't that right? Isn't that right, Sir Ronnie? What's my point? Oh, I've invented a new dance. Anybody up for it? It's called the Bosphorus Hug. Maddox, Berman, you'll dance with me.
He turns to his right.
Dag. Come on, Daggers.
Let's eat first. Sit down.
Almashi looks at Maddox, who squirms.
We'll bathe at Brighton. The fish you'll frighten when you're in your bathing suit so thin. We'll make
the shellfish toward the band.
Grin. Fin to fin, they're playing it far too slowly, but these were the words, actually, before they were cleaned up. Might be a song for you, Mrs. Fish.
Shut up, old girl. You're completely blasted. Sit down.
Absolutely right. Shut up. Shut up.
Maddox steers him back to the dinner table.
Sorry. I'm so sorry. I can't think what came over me. Lashing with apologies all around.
Servants in red fezes step forward and remove covers from the dinner plates. Almashi meets Catherine's cold gaze across the table, then drinks his champagne. Later, couples dance. Fuad performs a jazzy high-stepping jig while Catherine dances with Geoffrey's colleague, Rupert. Outside the room, Almashi leans on a pillar and watches them. In a black beaded dress, Catherine puts an arm around Rupert's neck and follows his light-footed lead.
Thank you.
She kisses the young man's cheek, then walks out into the ornately tiled corridor. Almashi, fuming against a wall, surprises her.
Why were you holding his collar?
What?
What? That boy. That little boy. You were holding his collar. You were gripping his collar. What for?
He pushes her into a corner.
Is he next? You're going to drag him into your little room? Where is it? Is this it?
She turns her face away.
I've watched you. I've watched you at garden parties, on verandas, at the races. How can you stand there? How can you ever smile as if your life had capsized?
You know why?
Almashi gingerly fingers her bare back.
Dance with me.
No.
Dance with me. I want to touch you. I want the things which are mine, which belong to me.
Tensing under his touch, she turns to face him.
Do you think you're the only one who feels anything? Is that what you think?
Catherine walks abruptly away. Now, in the monastery, Almashi turns his ghostly white head on his pillow. Kerosene lamplight shines through fine white hairs on his scalp. At the foot of his bed, Hannah mends some clothes.
Why don't you go? Get some sleep.
Would you like me to?
He nods stiffly with drooping eyes.
Good night.
Taking her mending kit, Hannah leaves the room. Her patient gazes forlornly into space as she shuts the door behind her. In the hallway, something on the floor catches her eye, and she bends to one knee to pick it up. At the top of the stairs, a tiny snail shell burns with a fat flame. Hannah spies another shell lamp at the bottom. Lighting her way with the first shell, she hopscotches into the orchard in her flowered dress and army jacket. More shell lamps trail across the courtyard, leading her to the algae-spotted cistern, then down a grass path to a stable. As Hannah pushes open the tall wooden door, her candlelight throws dancing shadows over her porcelain-smooth face. Kip's silhouette stands in the darkness behind her as she approaches a flatbed horse cart aglow with lamps.
Hannah.
Kip emerges and gazes at Hannah with dark, gentle eyes.
Kip.
Inside the monastery, Caravaggio glares out a window and puffs a cigarette. From his upper-story view, he watches the wooden stable door, framed by flickering lamps, close. Later, under a dawn sky, Hannah rides behind Kip on his motorcycle through a town plaza. Some children play with a stone in front of an ancient church pocked with artillery shells. Hannah rushes through the door ahead of Kip, smiling expectantly as she nears the altar.
Just wait. Don't look at anything yet.
Hundreds of stacked sandbags form a high pyramid beneath a system of ropes hung loosely from the ceiling. Hannah smiles as Kip fastens a climbing harness around her hips, then screws closed a metal ring attached to the thickest of the ropes. Kip's heavy-lidded eyes gaze into hers.
Wait.
Pressing a stick-like flare into her hand, he stretches out her arm. With a flourish, Kip uncaps it. Scrambling up the sandbags, he grabs an anchor rope and leaps off, lifting Hannah off the floor.
Kip!
She flies up toward the ceiling, illuminating life-sized figures painted on the church's walls. Kicking her legs, she steers herself around to view one of the murals. Her eyes dart over a regal scene through the flare's smoke and brilliant greenish light. A medieval woman gazes back at Hannah with a soft smile. Far below, Kip works the ropes and flies Hannah to the other wall. The flare washes white light over the murals. Hannah breaks into a grin and lowers the light to see Kip. He watches her through the swirling silver smoke as she spins above a table of twinkling votive candles. A painted man with a graying beard peers down aloofly with half-closed eyes. Kip squats with the ropes, then backsteps. Hannah glides over the sandbag pyramid. Her short hair flies back from her grinning cheeks as she spins, taking it all in. Releasing the ropes, Kip lowers her to the floor. They embrace.
Oh, thank you.
Later in the stable, Hannah lies naked on Kip's back on the flatbed horse cart. Propping her chin on his shoulder, she looks at his restful face.
If one night I didn't come to see you, what would you do?
I try not to expect you.
Yes, but if it got late and I hadn't shown up,
then I think there must be a reason.
You wouldn't come to find me?
His dark eyebrows draw together.
That makes me never want to come here.
Kip stares thoughtfully. Hannah's tousled hair bounces as she shakes her head.
Then I tell myself, spends all day searching. In the night he wants to be found.
He eases out from under her and props himself on his arm.
I do want you to find me. I do want to be found.
Hannah's broad mouth smiles. In the pale light of morning, Sergeant Hardy comes to the stable door and uses a loose board as a knocker. Hannah answers with her dress quickly thrown on.
Ah, was looking for Lieutenant Singh.
He's sleeping.
Only we've got to go to work.
I'll tell him. What is it? Is it a mine?
It's a bomb, a bioviaduct.
Hannah pulls him aside.
Does he have to go?
Beg pardon?
What if you can find him? Sergeant, not today, not this morning.
What's happening? Am I needed?
Afraid so, sir.
Tucking in his turban, Kip trots off.
Don't go. I'm frightened.
This is what I do. I do this every day.
Hannah's dress hangs loosely off her cream-white shoulder. Later, by a riverbank, a 6-foot-tall bomb stands in a shaft filled with water. Climbing in knee-deep, Kip surveys the bomb coated with thick mud. Taking a rag from his pocket, he wipes through the muck, revealing a stenciled number.
Hardy! Serial number! KKIP!
On the bank above, Hardy writes it down.
KKIP! 2600's that! I'll get the oxygen!
Farther downriver, Hannah urgently pedals a bicycle along a dirt path. In the shaft, Kip douses the bomb's fuse casing with liquid oxygen. Clouds of frost fog sink at his feet as the liquid bubbles around the casing. On the path, Hannah comes to an intersecting road. A column of American tanks approaches, blocking her way. GIs wave the stars and stripes. In the shaft, Kip rests his heavily gloved hand on the shell and pries the fuse casing with a covered screwdriver. On the road, the tanks keep coming. Hannah scowls and falls into line with them. The water around the bombshell begins to ripple. Kip's mallet and wire cutters vibrate on a ledge.
Hardy, what's happening?
Can't see, sir. It's from the road.
The mallet falls in.
Corporal!
A soldier cups his hands around his mouth.
Tank, sir! I don't know what it's about!
Stop him!
Kip steadies the shell. The tanks approach the viaduct.
No!
Hardy! No!
What is this? A bloody carnival!
The fuse has snapped! What's happened? Is it armed?
Kip falls back, his mouth agape.
Hang on, sir. Be right with you. Can you see the detonators?
Kip's face falls slack.
You've got to cut it, sir. That frost won't last.
On the bridge, Hardy's corporal frantically waves his arms at the tank column. Below, Kip braces the wire cutter handles in his bare fingers. The tanks advance.
Go away!
Yes, sir.
This is making me incredibly angry.
I know, sir.
Kip's hand touches the frozen shell.
Watch out, my bitch!
Recoiling, Kip drops the cutters into the muddy water. He drops on all fours and gropes through the muck.
Can you feel it?
Far behind the tanks, Hannah pedals, standing up. Kip retrieves the cutters and rises, water dripping from his beard.
Cut it, sir. You've got to cut it.
I don't even know if this is the right wire.
Choose. Just choose a loop and cut it.
Kip squeezes the cutters. On the bank, Hardy's pale face freezes as Kip works the cutters free from a clipped wire, then braces himself against the shaft walls. Hardy puffs out misty breaths. In the shaft, Kip collapses against the massive shell. Later.
Get a blanket! Marlin, get a blanket!
Stop! It's over, sir! It's over! Jenny, surrender!
Hardy lifts the corporal off the ground in a bearish hug, then does the same to Kip. A soldier puts a blanket around Kip as Hannah rides up.
Heaven, in heaven. And my heart beats so bad.
Pedaling up beside him, she dismounts and they embrace.
And I seem to find the happiness I see.
Later, lightning flashes over the monastery. Hannah steps into the frescoed room, soaking wet and grinning.
Heaven,
it's raining.
Almashi rolls over to look at her. Later, Hardy, Kip, and Caravaggio parade Almashi through the courtyard on a stretcher. Hannah tries to keep up, holding an umbrella over Almashi.
Like the gamblers lucky strip.
Almashi grins as they jostle him.
When we're out to...
With lightning flashing, they run out into the yard and follow a muddy path around the cistern.
Oh, I'd love to climb a mountain.
Swinging the umbrella, Hannah falls behind. Almachi stretches out his arm toward her as they dash back to the house. Inside, Hannah dances with Caravaggio.
Here, come and dance with us.
Later.
Oh, come on.
Hannah and Caravaggio sway to the music. Almachi sits propped up in bed, watching. In the town, a band of accordionists plays at the edge of a piazza filled with dancing couples. British soldiers run through the crowd. Hardy follows, wearing only his boxers.
Come on, son! Let's raise that flag!
Hardy's coming! On he goes! Here comes the mouthspot! Hey, I'm going up! Get him!
They prop a ladder up against a fountain. Hardy pushes a man off and starts to climb.
Hey, where's the helmet?
Clutching a Chianti bottle, he climbs toward the statue at the top of the fountain. His pants still trail from one of his shoes. At the top, he waves the Union Jack.
We're going home!
At the monastery, Kip stands near the window. Behind him, a flash lights up the hillside. He turns.
What was that?
Hannah grins as Caravaggio twirls her. Kip scans the hillside, then dashes out. At the piazza, army ambulances park beside the fountain, where only the statue's legs remain atop a bloody pedestal. Kip arrives on his motorcycle.
Sergeant Hardy, sir. It's a booby trap. He was running up the Union Jack, sir. Up off that statue, and it just went off, sir.
He goes to the ambulance.
Sergeant Hardy climbed up, sir, just for a lark, sir. Should have been me. It was my idea.
Sir, you don't want to look.
A woman sobs, covered in blood.
Who's that girl?
His fiancé, sir.
Hardy's?
He kept it a bit dark.
Daytime. In the stable, Kip sits below a window, his hair hanging loose over his bare shoulders.
Kip?
Hannah stands outside.
Kip, it's me. I'm so sorry about what happened. Can I talk to you? Kip?
He sits straight-backed.
Kip, why won't you talk to me? Kip.
She pushes against the wooden doors, then kicks them.
No! Let me come in!
Inside, pale light washes over Kip's expressionless face. Hannah storms away. Kip sits motionless. Nighttime. Beside the monastery, a half moon hangs low in the sky. In one of the windows, a light glides through a room. Inside, Hannah sits in the loft, peering down through the hole in the ceiling.
Hannah tells me you're leaving.
There's going to be trials. They want me to interpret. Don't they know I'm allergic to courtrooms?
Caravaggio sets his pistol down and takes off his jacket.
So, I come across the hospital convoy, looking for this stuff. This nurse, Mary, tells me about you and Hannah hiding in some monastery in,
what you call it? Retreat?
He fills a syringe.
How you came out of the desert and you were burned. You didn't remember your name, but you knew the words to every song that ever was, and you had one possession, a copy of Herodotus. And it was filled with letters and cuttings. Then I know it's you.
He tightens a strap around his arm and injects the morphine.
Me?
Slumping against the wall, Caravaggio flexes his arm and sets down the needle.
I saw you writing in that book at the embassy in Cairo. When I had thumbs and you had a face and a name.
I see.
Before you went over to the Germans, before you found a way to get Rommel's spy across the desert and inside British headquarters. He took some pretty good photographs. I saw mine in that torture room in Tobruk. So, it made an impression.
I had to get back to the desert. I'd made a promise. The rest meant nothing to me.
What did you say?
The rest meant nothing to me.
There was a result to what you did. It wasn't just another expedition. It did this.
If the British hadn't unearthed that photographer, thousands of people could have died.
Thousands of people did die. Just different people.
Yes. Like Maddox?
What?
You know, he shot himself. Your partner. When he found out you were a spy.
Told Maddox I was a spy. No, I was never a spy.
In the desert.
It's ghastly. It's like a witch hunt. Anybody remotely foreign is suddenly a spy. So watch out.
Right. We didn't care about countries, did we?
Brits, Arabs, Hungarians, Germans. None of that mattered, did it? It was something finer than that.
Yes, it was.
Maddox smiles faintly.
I'll leave the plane in Kufra Oasis. So, if you need it. Right.
Hard to know how long one's talking about. We might all be back in a month or two.
Maddox stoops down and takes a handful of sand. He lets some run through his fingers, then pockets the rest.
I have to teach myself not to read too much into everything. It comes with too long having to read so much into hardly anything at all.
Almashi nods gently, then extends a hand.
Goodbye, my friend.
Allah ma'ak, ya Habibi.
There is no God. But I hope someone looks after you.
In case you're still wondering, this is called a suprasternal notch.
He fingers the base of his throat. Almashi gives a sober nod.
Come and visit us in Dorset when all this nonsense is over.
He turns, takes a few slow steps, then looks back.
You'll never come to Dorset.
He steps up a sandy bank, the sun glaring down on his cropped leather jacket. Almashi watches him, then bows his head.
So you didn't know Maddox shot himself?
Gaping, he shakes his head.
And you didn't kill the Cliftons?
He swallows dryly. Above them, Hannah lets out a heavy breath. Caravaggio watches Almashi intently as he tries to form words. Tears glisten on his leathery cheek.
Maybe I did.
In the desert. Jeffrey's yellow biplane flies over Almashi.
I was packing up our base camp at the Cave of Swimmers. Clifton offered to fly down from Cairo to collect me. He flew like a madman always, so I took no notice.
Flying low, the plane comes in fast as Almashi goes to his luggage. In the cockpit, Jeffrey glares steadily. Almashi looks up as the plane suddenly hits the sand and plows toward him. He rolls into a ditch as the plane hurtles overhead, showering him with sand. Pieces break off the plane as it tumbles, then skids to a stop on its side. Almashi stumbles through a cloud of smoke and dust. In the cockpit, Jeffrey sits behind a broken windshield, his head hanging. Almashi peers into his bloody face, then looks up at the front seat.
Catherine. Dear God, Catherine, what are you doing here?
Can't get out. Can't move.
She sits stiffly in the front seat, her goggles askew.
Surprise, is it? Poor Jeffrey. And you? Must have known all the time. He was shouting, I love you, Catherine. I love you so much. Is he badly hurt?
He glances back at Jeffrey's body.
I have to get you out.
Please don't move me.
I have to get you out.
It hurts too much.
I know, I'm sorry. Come on.
He slides his arms around her.
No!
She winces as he pulls her out. Later, he carries her wrapped in a parachute along a sandstone ledge. The parachute's silky white tail flutters in the wind. Catherine gazes at his somber face.
Why did you hate me?
What?
Don't you know you drove everybody mad?
Shh. Don't talk.
You speak so many bloody languages and you never want to talk.
He manages a thin smile, then looks down at her neck. The silver thimble hangs from a cord.
You're wearing the thimble.
Of course. You idiot. I always wear it. I've always worn it. I've always loved you.
He presses his cheek against hers and breaks into anguished sobs. He makes his way along the wind-carved ledge, the end of the parachute fluttering behind him. Later, in the cave, a beam of light passes over thick stalactites. Catherine holds a battery lantern as Almashi carries her in and lays her down on her back.
It's so cold.
I know. I'm sorry.
He sets the lantern down beside her.
I'll make a fire.
He drapes his jacket over her. Later, he lights a pile of twigs.
Did you get Jeffrey out of the plane?
Yes, I did.
Good. It's good, thank you.
He tends the small fire.
Listen to me, Catherine. You've broken your ankle, and I'm going to have to try and bind it. I think you've also broken your wrist, and maybe some ribs, which is why it's hurting you to breathe. I'm going to have to walk to El Taj. Although given all the traffic in the desert these days, I'm bound to bump into one army or another.
And then I'll come back, and you'll be fine.
You promise? I wouldn't want to die here. I don't want to die in the desert. I've always had rather an elaborate funeral in mind. Particular hymns, and I know exactly where I want to be buried. In our garden where I grew up, with a view of the sea. So promise me you'll come back for me.
I promise. I'll come back for you. I promise. I'll never leave you. You have plenty of water and food. I'll open them for you.
He sets a couple of square tins beside her, then picks up his book.
A good read.
He places it beside her shoulder.
Don't waste this.
He switches off the lantern.
Will you bury Jeffrey? I know he's dead.
I'm sorry, Catherine.
I know.
She shuts her eyes. Tears glisten at the corners.
Every night, I cut out my heart.
He tears the parachute with a knife.
But in the morning, it was full again.
Catherine smiles softly. As Almashi leans over, she strokes the side of his face.
Darling. My darling.
He takes her hand and presses it to his lips, then gently kisses her mouth. She gazes at him as he draws back, then kisses her again. The fire's light flickers on the rough walls of the cave. Now, in the desert, a figure appears as a speck on a vast sun-baked plain. It's Almashi trotting wildly down the side of a dune, clutching a shoulder bag.
Be there when the land starts playing. Remember when we get there.
Keeping a steady pace, he walks along a ridge, silhouetted by the setting sun.
Well, the high brass will be there. Down to get you. Taxi, honey.
I stopped at noon and at twilight. 3 days there on the foot, I told her. Then 3 hours back by car. Don't go anywhere. I'll be back. I'll be back.
His footprints trail over one dune in an endless, rippled expanse. Now, at the base of a crumbling fortress, Almashi walks along a narrow ledge. A soldier in a khaki uniform spots him. Later, he leads Almashi to an officer at a desk.
Sorting for the desert, sir.
Almashi staggers in.
Morning.
Covered in dust, he moves his lips. The officer glances at the soldier, who pours a glass of water and hands it to Almashi. Almashi glimpses a car. He takes a sip, then doubles over.
Hey, golly. Where have you come from, then?
There's been an accident. I need a doctor to come with me. And I need to borrow this car. I'll pay, of course, and I need morphine.
Where's your papers, sir?
What?
If I could just see some form of identification.
I'm sorry, I'm not making sense. Forgive me. I've been walking. A woman is badly injured in the Gilf Kebir, the Cave of Swimmers, and a member of the Royal Geographical Society.
Right. Now, if I could just take your name.
Count Lazlo de Almashi.
Almashi? Do you mind spelling that?
Look, listen to me, will you?
What nationality would that be?
A woman is dying. My wife is dying. I have been walking. I have been walking for 3 days. I do not want to spell my name. I want you to give me this car.
I understand you're agitated. Perhaps if you'd like to sit down, I can radio back to HQ.
No. No, don't. Don't radio anybody. Shut!
He grabs him.
Fucking car!
The soldier hits him. He blacks out. In the Cave of Swimmers, the lantern casts a halo of light over Catherine as she lies on her side, writing in Almashi's book. She writes neatly in pencil. The fire has gone now, and I'm horribly cold. She holds her bandaged wrist across her chest. More words. We die. Putting down the pencil, she taps the lantern on the ground. It flickers. She furrows her brow. The weak light goes out, leaving Catherine in total darkness. In the desert city, Almashi rides in the back of an army jeep.
Stop the car, please. A woman has died!
Listen, Fritz, if I have to listen to another word from you, I'm going to give you a fucking good hiding!
Fritz? What are you talking about, Fritz?
Well, that's your name, isn't it? Count fucking arsehole von Bismarck. What's that supposed to be then, Irish?
Please! You have to listen! Catherine!
In the desert, a long plume of smoke trails behind a train. In a boxcar, Almashi sits chained to a wall. He peers outside through a small hole, then looks to an army guard.
Excuse me. I also need to use the lavatory.
You'll have to wait.
It's urgent.
Sarge! Sarge! Jerry wants you, and left. Say to sergeant.
The beefy sergeant lumbers through the car.
Where are we going, please?
Well, up north, to the coast. Benghazi.
Soon be there. You can get your boat back home, then.
Aye, go on, then. Here, you take him. I've been up and down this bloody train all day.
The sergeant unlocks the chains and tosses the keys to the young guard. As the guard leads Almashi away in handcuffs, the sergeant leans against the wall and lights a cigarette. In the next car, the guard sits while Almashi goes to the laboratory door.
Doesn't open!
The guard stands and joins him. Almashi jabs him in the gut with his elbow, then knocks him back. He hits the guard again, then shoves him against the wall, pressing his handcuff chain across his throat. The guard reddens and mashes his hand into Almashi's face. Pressing harder, Almashi glares fiercely back. The guard collapses and slides down the wall behind a stack of crates. Almashi glances at the sergeant pacing in the next car, then unlocks his cuffs. Later, at the last boxcar, Almashi climbs out, hangs off the back of the train, then jumps. Landing face down in the sand, he rolls onto his back and winces. Sweat and dust cover his face. Turning over, he drags himself toward the tracks and struggles to his feet. Dragging one foot, he limps in the opposite direction of the train. At the monastery.
So, yes. She died because of me. Because I loved her. Because I had the wrong name.
In the attic loft, Hannah watches, biting her lip. In the frescoed room, Caravaggio sits against a wall.
And you'd never get back to the cave?
I did get back. I kept my promise. I was assisted by the Germans. There was a trade. I had our expedition maps. And after the British made me their enemy, I gave their enemy our maps.
Guten Flug.
In the desert, a German officer takes a portfolio. Almashi turns to the silver biplane and rips down a cardboard sign reading, "See you in Dorset."
So I got back to the desert and to Catherine. In Maddox's English plane with German gasoline. When I arrived in Italy on my medical chart, they wrote English patient. Isn't that funny? After all that, I became English.
Caravaggio gazes out the window.
You get to the morning and the poison leaks away, doesn't it?
He smiles to himself.
Black nights. I thought I would kill you.
You can't kill me. I died years ago.
No, I can't kill you now.
Hannah stands in the loft doorway, leaning against the frame. Outside, Kip takes down his tent. As the canvas settles on the ground, Hannah walks from the monastery, wearing her army jacket over her blue dress. Kip pulls up the tent stakes.
We've been posted. North of Florence.
He picks up a striped scarf, and his gaze meets Hannah's. He tosses her the scarf.
I was thinking yesterday, the patient and Hardy, everything that's good about England. I couldn't even say what that was.
We didn't exchange two personal words, and we'd been together through some terrible things.
He was engaged to a girl in the village. I mean, and us, he never once, he didn't ask me if I could spin the ball at cricket or the Kama Sutra or
He fumbles with a shirt, trying to button it. Hannah reaches out and he tosses it to her. Gazing toward the monastery, Kip lets out a heavy breath.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
You loved him.
Kip glowers, then looks at Hannah. She smiles warmly. Looking away, Kip rests his hands on his hips and sighs. Inside the monastery, Almashi lies on his side, staring into the distance. In the desert, Almashi walks down a path to the Cave of Swimmers, then steps into its dark opening. Inside, his flashlight beam sweeps the painted wall. Beneath rows of walking figures, slender strokes render a few graceful swimmers. Slowly, he paces further into the cave, then stops. Catherine lies on her side, still wrapped in the parachute. Almashi shines the flashlight beam on her still peaceful face. Pulling a wool blanket up over her shoulder, he lies behind her. He strokes her hair.
Catherine.
At the monastery, Almashi lies on his back, completely still, his eyes locked in a faraway gaze. Hannah leans over him, bringing her face close to his.
I'm still here.
You'd better be.
Don't depend on it, will you? A little bit of air in my lungs. Each day gets less and less. Which is all right. It's quite all right. I've been speaking to Caravaggio, my research assistant. He tells me there's a ghost in the cloisters. I can join him. Boy.
Hannah swings open the window. In the yard, Kip sits astride his motorcycle, loaded down with duffel bags. Outside, Hannah runs her hand along Kip's arm and gazes at his somber face. She offers a subdued smile.
I'll always go back to that church. Look at my paintings.
I'll always go back to that church.
So one day we'll meet?
Kip smiles, his dark eyes meeting Hannah's. He drives off down a dusty road lined with cypress trees. Hannah presses her hand to her mouth as he disappears around a bend. Still gazing down the road, she lets her hand drop, then heads back to the house. Later, in the frescoed room, she takes a vial of morphine from a small box beside the bed. Her rosy lips curl in a peaceful smile. Flicking the glass tube with her finger, she scrapes a file against a narrow point, then breaks off the top. Almashi reaches out his scar-stiffened hand and tips over a box of vials. Gazing steadily at Hannah, he slides the vials toward her, one at a time. Hannah stares at the five glass capsules. Almashi looks up at her, evenly, then lets his gaze fall. Fighting back tears. tears, Hannah resumes her work. She flicks the end of a second file, then hesitates before breaking it open. Almashi watches her.
Thank you.
She flinches as she snaps another, then covers her face.
Read to me, will you?
Hannah tries to collect herself.
Read me to sleep.
She nods. As she works, a tear rolls down her cheek. She pushes the plunger on the syringe, forcing out a small stream of fluid. Almashi stares at her, remembering the cave where he lies beside Catherine's body, stroking her hair.
My darling, I'm waiting for you. How long is a day in the dark? Or a week?
Hannah lies beside Almashi, reading from his book. She sits up.
The fire is gone now, and I'm horribly cold.
I really ought to drag myself outside, but then there'd be the sun. I'm afraid I waste the light on the paintings and on writing these words. We die.
We die. We die rich with lovers and tribes, tastes we have swallowed, bodies we have entered and swum up like rivers,
fears we've hidden in, like this wretched cave.
In the cave, Almashi paints Catherine's neck and face with lines of dust.
I want all this marked on my body. We're the real countries, not the boundaries drawn on maps, the names of powerful men.
He draws his fingers slowly across her pale cheek, leaving a smudge of ochre dust. At the mouth of the cave, he carries out her body, wrapped in the parachute.
I know you'll come and carry me out into the Palace of Winds.
Her head rests limply against his shoulder. He staggers forward, his teeth bared in anguished cries.
That's all I've wanted. To walk in such a place with you. With friends. An earth without maps.
He carries her toward the plain. At the monastery, Hannah sits beside him.
The lamp's gone out. And I'm writing. In the darkness.
Hannah gazes at him. He lies still, his eyes fixed in an empty gaze. A gentle smile curls Hannah's lips, and she shuts her eyes. In the desert, the silver biplane lifts off from a level clearing and glides above a ridge of orange-brown cliffs. It banks gracefully to the right and disappears behind a bluff. In the monastery, Almashi's bed lies empty in the sunlit room. Hannah steps in, wearing her army jacket over her dress. She spots Almashi's book on the bedside table. Clutching the book, she dashes out.
Hannah?
Outside, Caravaggio stands with a buxom woman.
This is Gioia.
Giorno.
Buongiorno.
They exchange kisses.
She'll take you as far as Florence.
I can get me back.
Hannah climbs into the open truck bed, joining a man and three girls. Caravaggio closes the tailgate, then sits in the cab beside Gioia. He flashes a seductive smile and they drive off. As they make their way down the narrow road, Hannah gazes at the monastery's tall, square tower. Turning, she looks at a short-haired girl sitting across from her. The girl gazes back with dark, thoughtful eyes, and Hannah smiles. In the desert, the biplane soars above golden peaks, then out over the endless expanse of dunes. In the front seat of the plane, Catherine's body sits hunched in the seat, a corner of the white parachute fluttering out. Behind her, Almashi pilots, glancing down at the sand's shadowy contours. Sun warms the rippling beige dunes. In the truck, a breeze ruffles Hannah's hair as she looks ahead down the road. Her face passes from shadow into light as the sun flashes between the cypress trees. The row of slender trees ends, revealing the full sun, its radiance filling the sky with silvery light. This film has been described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH Boston. Described by Samantha Manahan, Brian Gould, Robin Sitton, and Christina Faust. Descriptions read by Wendy Sacchichini. Major funding for DVS is provided by the United States Department of Education. Credits roll. The cast. Ralph Fiennes as Almashi. Juliette Binoche as Hannah. Willem Dafoe as Caravaggio. Kristen Scott Thomas as Catherine Clifton. Naveen Andrews as Kip. Colin Firth as Jeffrey Clifton. Julian Wadham as Maddox. Jürgen Prochnow as Major Muller. Kevin Waitley as Hardy. Clive Merrison as Fenelon Barnes. Nino Castelnuovo as D'Agostino. Hisham Rustam as Fuad. Peter Roaring as Berman. Geordie Johnson as Oliver. Tori Higginson as Mary. A message appears. While a number of the characters who appear in this film are based on historical figures, and while many of the areas described, such as the Cave of Swimmers and its surrounding desert, exist and were explored in the 1930s, it is important to stress that this story is a fiction, and that the portraits of the characters who appear in it are fictional, as are some of the events and journeys. Credits continue. Unit production managers, Franco Bellotti and Lynn Cameron. First Assistant Director Steve Andrews. Second Assistant Director Emma Schofield. International Distribution Consultants J&M Entertainment. Makeup Fabrizio Sforza. Prosthetics by Jim Henson's Creature Shop. Co-costume designer Gary Jones. Canadian casting Deirdre Bowen. German casting Risa Kess. Assistant Directors Luigi Vellini and Andrea Girolami. Script Supervisor Diane Dreyer. Production Coordinator Daniela Vecchi. Production Coordinator Rome and Via Reggio, Judith Goodman. Production Coordinator Rome, Francesca Cingolani. Art Director and Set Decorator, Aurelio Crognola. For Jim Henson's Creature Shop, Visual Supervisor, John Stevenson. Creative Project Supervisor, Neil Scanlon. Production Supervisor, Karen Cassie. Special Effects Supervisor, Richard Conway. Visual Effects by Digital Film London. Aerial Unit, Airplane Coordinator, Pino Valente. Pilot of Maddox's Tiger Moth, Clive Watson. Pilot of Clifton's Steerman, Franco Actis. Tunisian crew, International Monastir Films Fiscal. Representative, Rita Turkey. Unit manager, Hamid Elouk. Post-production, associate editor, Pat Jackson. Post-production supervisor and first assistant, avid editor, Eddie Blyman. First assistant film editors, Rosemary Conti and Daniel Farrell. Original music recorded by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, Harry Rabinowitz, conductor. John Constable, piano soloist. Recorded at Air Studios London and Yad Music France. Music sound designer Georges Rody. Recording engineer Keith Grant. Shepherd's Hotel Jazz Orchestra, recorded at Angel Recording Studios London. Conducted and arranged by Ronnie Hazelhurst. Sound engineer John Timperley. Music editor Roberto Randles. The producer and director wish to thank Convento di Sant'Anna, Comune di Pienza, Croce Rossa Italiana, Hotel des Bains Lido di Venezia, Comune di Trieste, the Tunisian government and the Tozer district governor, the Royal Geographic Society, the British Library, British Path, G.H. Mum and CIE, Anderson and Shepherd, Angels and Burmans, Costume Tirelli, Stepping Out, and Tunis Air. Read the Vintage and Miramax books. Soundtrack recording available on Fantasy Records. All film editing, sound editing, and Dolby Digital Mix completed at the Saul Zantz Film Center, Berkeley, California. Copyright 1996, Tiger Moth Productions Incorporated, all rights reserved. Filmed on location in Italy and Tunisia.